You are listening to Love Sport Breakfast with me, Richard Lee, and Patrick Christie's. There's plenty going on. We've got some special guests on the line, actually, today, haven't we, which I want to talk about. Dillian White, in particular.
Yeah, we've got Dillian White's trainer
on the line.
Yeah, we have had Dillian White on Love Sport before, but we've got his trainer on, Mark Tibbs. He's going to be coming on. Also, we did a bit of digging yesterday. We found out Open winner Shane Lowry. We found out where his home golf course is, and we've got them coming on. So we've got some representatives of his home golf course who were all screaming themselves hoarse yesterday. They're going to be on the show later on as well. And Conservative Party MP Daniel Kavczynski is going to give his take on the Tory leadership race as well.
Oh, it promises to be a fascinating show.
Well, just bursting into the week.
Well, this is it. It is Monday. So we're going to bring the energy this Monday.
Yeah.
Because we've had a nice weekend. You've had a nice weekend.
Lovely. Yeah, really good. Really good. I think that's it. But by Friday, it'll very much be like, who have we got on? Well, Coco the Clown is here. No reason. We just couldn't book anyone else. Couldn't be bothered.
It's kind of what happens. It disintegrates towards the end of the week. So make the most of today is the message.
That's what I'd say, listeners, is just buckle in for today and expect nothing this good for the foreseeable future.
Fantastic. Good-o. Well, real positive start.
Yeah.
Let's talk very positive. Shane Lowry.
Oh, what a man. What a mighty fine man.
Indeed. Not only did he win, won comfortably. And I know that our producer Kieran's really excited by the fact that he's the first man with a beard to have won for a long, long time. Everybody seems to be really excited by this fact.
Well, I think it's magnificent. So look, Shane Lowry won by a margin of 6 strokes, beating England's Tommy Fleetwood, of course, at the Open at Royal Port Rush yesterday. Fantastic. I mean, really, he was a rank outsider. He's just scooped £1.55 million. Pounds, so he's a lot wealthier off it. We're going to be doing a bit of a profile on Shane Lowry a bit later on. He has had a very interesting route into golf. Didn't really start playing until his early to mid-teens, and was bullied for his weight as well. He's self-professed as being quite lazy, but there's a really interesting backstory with him, so we're going to get stuck into that in a little bit. Yes, absolutely. But a disappointment, of course, for Rory McIlroy as well, who got very emotional after he missed the cut. Yet another example of Rory McIlroy choking, unfortunately, and this just seems to be a recurring theme.
It's the first time it's been at Port Rush. We spoke about this earlier, in fact, last week, in over 60 years. Your thoughts on the course? It was quite a test.
I thought it was beautiful. Like it played really, really well in the end as well, and that was despite some quite damaging weather in terms of the gales and the rain. Look, Royal Port Rush is a sensational course that has been revolutionised as well, and a lot of the credit there has to go to the people behind the scenes, because they've basically, you know, turned this club around, frankly. Harry Colt designed it. It's a links course, which means that basically actually a lot of it is kind of reclaimed land from the sea, essentially. Therefore, it's got a sandy base, and it just plays very true, and it's just a very firm course as well.
Interesting. Yes, only Tony Finau made level par. Everybody else was over par. It was interesting watching a couple of the interviews afterwards. One in particular, Lee Westwood, who it was nice to see Lee Westwood like that, like so happy. He obviously had a fantastic 4 days and shot a very good score. But he was saying, you know, he shot, I think, 73 yesterday. Yeah. And he said that's a very, very good score on a day like yesterday. And it was tough. The conditions were really tough.
Yeah, bear in mind, though, that Rory McIlroy set the course record there when he was 16 and with a round of 61. And yesterday, Shane Lowry could only manage, I say only manage, I mean, obviously it was good enough for him, but 63. I mean, that, to put that into context of how excellent Rory McIlroy used to be. It's sensational, isn't it, really?
Indeed.
How much do you reckon a round of golf cost you at Royal Port Rush, Rich?
Oh, go on, £100.
220.
There you go, great fact. 220
quid for a round of golf.
Wow, 18 holes. So each hole is like £13.
Yeah, I mean, but then you've got to factor in the amount of balls that you lose, when I throw the club into the lake.
Yeah.
All that kind of stuff.
Before you know it, you spent £1,000.
Oh, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
There's so much more you could do with £1,000.
Getting absolutely battered on the back of the golf cart. All sorts. I mean, it all adds up, Pritch.
It does. In fact, Stenson snapped his club yesterday.
Good man.
Good man. That's what we like to see.
Man. I like
to see more
that.
Players like that.
Passion.
lunacy, some might say. Zinedine Zidane has been getting a bit of stick from Gareth Bale's agent. Gareth Bale, of course, reportedly off. I know Zidane wants rid of Bale, made it very clear. Apparently, there is an opportunity for Gareth Bale to go to China. You know, and if he wants to win things, then maybe that's a good place to go.
Yeah.
You know, an emerging market, of course. Everyone's talking about China these days.
Well,
apparently, £1 million a week net.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, he's got a million reasons to want to go to China, hasn't he? Because I think back in the day, it used to be a case of, like, if you were in the military and you'd got things a little bit wrong, they'd send you out to like Siberia or like the Caucasus or somewhere, wouldn't they? Where you just end up rotting in a frozen hell. Yeah. And it feels a little bit like that's China now for football, because clearly no one in this country, no one really in Europe is able to match Gareth Bale's wages. And that clearly seems to be his main motivation. Apart from China, where they can just offer him £500,000 a week, pretty much, can't they?
Yeah.
So I find it staggering, really. Zinedine Zidane has said, look, we hope he leaves. I think it'd be better for everyone. And that's been an open secret, hasn't it, really, the kind of mutual disdain.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because Zidane's also said that it's not personal, but he has been unpopular. He's been unpopular for quite a while now at Real Madrid.
Yeah. It's not personal or anything, but he's got silly hair, he's carrying a bit of weight, and I don't like his attitude.
I don't like his Welsh accent. Doesn't really fit in. But the fact is, he's scored some vital goals over the period of time that he's been at Madrid. I think all in all, he's been a success there, I would say. He does seem to be deeply unpopular.
He went at the time, which a lot of people seem to forget, he went for a world record fee. And I think with Gareth Bale, he probably feels like he hasn't quite ever got the credit at Real Madrid that he deserves. It did take a little while for the fans to warm to him. He scored in Champions League finals. He's, you know, actually won them things. He's also been responsible actually for a couple of fantastic Clasico victories for Real. And I think he's never been shown the love that he would expect.
102 goals in 231 appearances, which is a very good return.
Bear in mind, quite a few of those appearances are off the bench.
Very true. And also, when you're with Ronaldo, who's averaging a goal a game, like, you're doing your part. He's still the biggest ever transfer they've had, more than Hazard and Ronaldo. So it does seem a little bit... Look, if this is the end of the road, I guess things can change pretty quickly. Last season, obviously, didn't go to plan for him. If it is the end of the road, it does come to that. It's then, do you want to come back to the Premier League? But realistically, at your age, what wage are you going to get in the Premier League? It's going to be very, very good, but it's certainly not going to be what could be offered in China. So then you have got a bit of a choice. Is it then a financial one now and you stay out your days, or do you want to come back to the Premier League?
Exactly. And the Sun have done a handy little guide. There's five reasons why it all went wrong for Gareth Bale. Ooh. First one, he's known as the loner dubbed the golfer. So obviously, basically, they're saying he plays too much golf there. Too many injuries is the second one. Bale has been sidelined with 20 injuries during his 6 years at Real Madrid and has missed a total of 72 games. Zinedine Zidane doesn't like him. That's the third reason. The fourth reason is that the fans have now turned on him. Basically, they're saying that he's, you know, he's not, well, he's not great, basically, is what they're saying. But the Real Madrid fans are pretty fickle, to be fair. And crucially, fifth, is that Eden Hazard is younger and better than him.
Right.
You know, and that does seem to be the crux of this matter, doesn't it? You could get rid of Gareth Bale, who is going bald disgracefully, and you can get in Eden Hazard, who is yet to go bald disgracefully.
Great head of hair.
Solid hair. That hair, that's, if there's one thing, you look at Eden Hazard and you think, if there's one thing I know about him, it's the fact that hair isn't going anywhere.
No, it'll still be there. Give it 10, 15, 20 years.
He'll do what he wants.
He won't need a transplant. No. There's plenty else going on as well. Of course, Dillian White with a good victory.
Absolutely, yeah. I'm really looking forward later on. We're speaking to Dillian White's trainer. We're speaking to him around 9 a.m. today, so stay tuned for that. But Dillian White survived a ninth round knockdown to overcome Oscar Rivas at the O2 in London at the weekend. Sensational, this. Dillian White, 31 years old, managed to win in a unanimous points decision against no mug, by the way, Oscar Rivas. And you've got to ask now, what's he got to do for his shot? They're saying he could still end up waiting 1,200 days, which is quite precise, really, for his shot against Deontay Wilder, which I don't quite know how they've reached that figure, but apparently that's just what he's being told. Anthony Joshua doesn't appear to want to fight him again, having already beaten him. And you just got to think, well, what's he got to do now for his shot? We had Conor Benn on, didn't we? Nigel's son, on Friday. And he was saying that basically, you know, what's he got to do? What more can this guy do in order to get his shot at the big time? He's improving all the time.
People are going to be scared of him, though. And it was interesting talking to Conor, because he made that point that if two fighters want a fight to happen, it will happen. And he literally said, look, if I want to fight you and you want to fight me, we're going to fight. It's as simple as that. So there ordinarily will be somebody avoiding it. And of course, Dillian White isn't going to avoid it. He's ready. You know, he wants anybody, doesn't he? But it's just, it is just a case now of who steps forward.
Yeah, and a little bit later on, we're going to be doing, there's a fascinating backstory of Dillian White. It includes the fact that he was a father at 13. Mm. He's been shot twice. He took his own bullet out of his leg and sewed it up because he didn't want his mum to find out. He's been stabbed multiple times. Only moved to England when he was 12 from Jamaica, where he was living in just abject poverty. It's an absolutely fascinating backstory, and we're going to get stuck into that a little bit later on.
Indeed. And of course, there's a big story. Petey has smashed his own world record in the 100-metre breaststroke and become the first man to go under 57 seconds.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, exactly. Petey, as Gazza would say. So swimming phenomenon, Adam Petey beat his own record In the men's 100 metre breaststroke, this happened yesterday, in fact. So he did it in under 57 seconds. He's 24 years old and he clocked in at 56.88, which is nearly 2 seconds ahead of his opponent.
This is Love Sport.
We have got inside our spaceship and we have taken off. And we have landed where, Patrick?
The moon?
Let's go there today.
Yeah.
Let's go there. No one's ever been there before, so it's nice for us to go there. What is today's Behind Closed Doors feature, Patrick?
Right, okay. So we're talking goalkeepers.
Yes.
And it's in light of David De Gea being offered what could be an absolutely sensational new contract for him at Manchester United. The Spanish stopper obviously has been at Manchester United for quite a long period of time. He's arguably, well, certainly in my opinion anyway, I think he's probably the best goalkeeper that Manchester United have had. I'd probably put him over Schmeichel. He set to sign a 6-year deal worth around £117 million. Now, a couple of things first and foremost. Just straight away, is that a good deal for him? And should he stay? What do you reckon?
Great deal for him. Look, it's a good fit, this. And I'm glad that it's coming to this conclusion. United needed to do something. Time is running out. Just over 2 weeks left of the transfer window. If they didn't get the deal done, he could have refused to have left and run his contract down, knowing that he's going to get this contract and more this time next year. Even if he has a disastrous season, even if he didn't play, he'd still get this kind of contract this time next year. So I'm glad that it looks like it's coming to a head. Credit to David De Gea, credit to his agents. I think they've driven this as high as they possibly can. I don't think they're going to get a penny more than this, but it is a fantastic deal for both him and the club.
Yeah, and it got me thinking about well, just how outrageous some contracts are. And specifically, so you know how like a pop star will have a rider? Mm. So you'll get there, it's just, it's the list of things that they need in their dressing room before they can go on and perform on stage. So just like exclusively blue M&Ms or like tartan-coloured paint or something. Yeah. But I want to know what some of the more ridiculous contract demands have been from some players. Do any players have just very strange things in their contracts or strange clauses in their contract that agents have had to try and get in for whatever reason?
Some do. I mean, look, mine was obviously quite basic coming onto Love Sport. Just want, Kopi Luwak every day and, that's delicious. Yeah.
What's that again, just for our listeners?
It's a real special type of coffee. Yeah. It's just the way that it's created and it's, we're going to details.
Cat eats it and then poos it out and then we drink it.
I thought it was a monkey.
Right, well, we'll have to...
Much better.
Anyway.
Much better.
Anyway, yeah.
Either way. Do you know what? I think as footballers, you can't really go down those paths and become a prima donna. I think it's a little bit different if you're a pop star, of course. But I think if you're a footballer and you're then demanding those kind of things, the furthest it'll go will be boots and the specification when it comes to your boots. And this will be more with the boot manufacturers and making them so they literally are perfect for your feet. And like David Beckham was known for having a new pair of boots every single game. Brad Friedel, new pair of goalkeeper gloves every single game. But I mean, they're kind of quite standard things now, I think. And I think a lot of players, given that they're earning the kind of money they are, to have a new pair of boots, new pair of gloves every week is nothing. You say it to a kid, they think it's incredible. A kid that might go through one pair of boots a season, two pairs of gloves a season, for instance, to think of Brad Friedel going through 70 or 80 pairs of gloves a season, each one costing £100, to a kid, that's amazing. To a professional footballer, it is just standard now.
Probably devalues it when you go to like various auctions. Or like just after dinner events where they raffle off like, oh, this is David Beckham's boots. Well, yeah, but he wore a new pair every single game. So there's millions of these.
There are literally millions around the world. Everyone's got a pair of David Beckham's boots now.
Everyone, exactly. It's like when you see those comic relief things and everything pans round. They've all got like football shirts on and there's just someone there with David Beckham's boots,
Anyway. And a look of disappointment.
I wanted Brad Friedel's gloves.
Yeah.
But just in terms of this contract with David De Gea, now, we don't know exactly what's gone on behind the scenes, but just generally when it comes to negotiating contracts, because David De Gea, for my money, didn't seem like he particularly wanted to stay at United.
Do you know and actually you'll appreciate this, and this comes back to your point you made earlier about Brexit.
Right.
I think he always wanted to stay. Deep down, I think he always wanted to stay, but I think, as you said about Brexit, you need to have the threat that you're going to leave. I think Pogba does this well as well. I think that there's always that lingering threat that he's going to leave, but ultimately he always seems to get a new contract. It's quite a basic negotiation style, but I think with David, I say that he always wanted to stay. I think he knows his worth, or he believes he knows his worth. So if he'd have said, a year ago, no, I'm staying at United, I love United, and that's been his line the whole time, then does he get £375,000 a week? This is where I think they've driven it to the absolute max. And they knew that they're so close to the end of this transfer window. This transfer window goes and he's not signed a contract. Man United are in serious trouble of him going for nothing.
Is it good to see goalkeepers finally now being paid as much as top-end outfield players, or certainly the echelon just below top-end outfield players?
Well, they are the most important player on the field. I think most people can agree that that's the case.
Everyone says that.
Of course, everybody.
They win you games.
They do. 15 points a season. That's the cliche. The last 2 years has been huge for goalkeeping in general, because I think, obviously, last summer being quite unique, the two big transfers. We go through a few, actually, in terms of what they're on. Edison's believed to be on £100,000 a week, so best part of just over £5 million a year. Alisson believed to be £4.7 million a year. Oblak signed a new deal worth apparently €10 million a year. Ter Stegen's meant to be on £4.7 million a year as well. So, I mean, look, this puts David De Gea well above these others. I would argue that if David De Gea does sign this, it's going to set a new benchmark, and the likes of Alisson, Edison, Oblak, Ter Stegen in particular will all feel that they're certainly on a level, if not the level above De Gea, and that's quite a big statement, but I certainly think that we spoke a lot about De Gea. I'm a massive fan of David De Gea, but I do think there are a couple of elements of his game that he's certainly not as good as Edison when it comes to distribution, for instance. I think Oblak's a good example of someone who aerially deals with balls that much better than David De Gea does. I still think David De Gea, when it comes to reflexes, power, shot stopping, to use a general term, he is still the best in the world. But now that he signs this, that does set a new benchmark for goalkeepers.
Do you feel pressure when you get a contract like this? And let's say it is worth £170 million over the course of the next 6 years, right? Does that add an element of pressure to your game? Can it make your head wobble, really?
It's not necessarily you. It'll be people's perception of you. He's going to be that much higher paid than all these other goalkeepers. So it might be fans more than anything, that it's an easy, an easy insult to give. If he does have a poor game, of course, there's some obvious insults you can give when he is the highest paid goalkeeper in the world. So will it add additional pressure? Look, he's already playing for Manchester United, arguably the most high profile club in the year. They've had a poor year. He's had so much stick last year, certainly back end of last year. It wasn't going his way at all. So he can deal with pressure. He's had to do it for a long, long time now. So we're earning a bit more money, increase the pressure marginally. I don't think it'll make much of a difference.
Do you still worry about Manchester United's model? Because when you look at what happened with Sanchez, for example, you know, you get him in on a free and you put him on an absolutely extortionate contract, something like £400,000 a week, I mean, for a bloke who looked like he didn't know how to kick a ball last season. And they've just kind of done it again with De Gea, who had quite a dodgy end to last season.
Yes, it's a fair. I worry less with De Gea, because let's not forget, De Gea's won the Player of the Year four times, five times, whatever it is. So like, he's there. The Man United fans absolutely adore him. You know, you've had Schmeichel, Van der Sar, now De Gea. You know, they've got a fantastic goalkeeper there. And if he is their goalkeeper now for the next 4 or 5 years, that's one position they do not need to worry about. So for the signings they've made this summer, a lot will argue this is the best signing they've made. So if you are going to give that kind of money, then it makes much more sense to give it to a De Gea than, of course, a Sanchez. And you would like to think that De Gea will keep his place in the team. He will be someone that the other players can look up to. And you don't mind if one of your highest paid players is somebody that's won the Player of the Year as many times as they had, is somebody that's such a fan's favourite, because then that gives everybody else something to aspire to, as opposed to Sanchez, where they'll look at him in a very different light.
Do you think United were on the cusp of something seriously, seriously bad happening? Because if you were looking at that club now and you were an outside player and they were looking to buy you, currently United can still go, well, you can play alongside Paul Pogba. You've got David De Gea in net, you know. But actually, and some of the players that are still there, for example, Marcus Rashford of this world, who will have offers. I know he's just signed, I believe he's just signed or is very close to signing a new contract at United. But you know, is this something that actually, had De Gea gone and Pogba, who may still go, you'd actually seriously really struggle to get people through the door?
Well, then, in terms of big names, and look, rightly or wrongly, of course, the top clubs, they want their marquee names. You know, in America, they made a position purely for that. You know, they had the DP rule that suddenly came in. It was effectively the David Beckham rule, where they said, you can bring in one player, doesn't have to fit in the wage cap. They can be paid whatever they want to be paid. And they did that because they knew they needed a marquee name per team, because that's what sells the shirts, that's what sells the tickets. Now, if United had lost Lukaku, Pogba, Sanchez and De Gea this summer, then you're looking at a team of a Daniel James, Rashford, a lot of younger players coming through, yet they could still be very good, but you haven't got those big names attached to the club. And it's often the big names that actually attracts other players. So it's interesting how the transfer window works. With a lot of teams, they want to announce their biggest signing first, because then the other signings then will be attracted by the fact that they've gone and brought in such a big name that it makes it much more appealing to then go and join the club, knowing that a big star has already joined before them.
Yeah, I mean, that's so true, isn't it, really? You know, look what happened with Real Madrid. And then to a much lesser extent, when United announced the signing of largely unknown Welsh winger Daniel James. Mm.
Which
there's
is
a contrast there, isn't there?
There is, and that's where, look, I'm sure we've touched on it. He'll be a fantastic player. So will Wan-Bissaka. But it's then, are they big? The thing is, I quite like the fact they've gone down this route now, because I think they've gone down the other route far too often and with the wrong players. Because there's no problem handing out massive contracts, providing you've got the right personality. If you've got the wrong character, then you give that big contract, that's them done. Their goals are achieved. They ticked off everything they want to do and they're done. You know, we talk about Gareth Bale. Look, if he goes to China, no disrespect, but that's a sign that he's going for one reason and one reason only, and he will be done.
Yeah. Well, look, exactly. You made some very, very good points, Rich. Informative, that, to get behind the scenes of Manchester United and David De Gea's transfer saga.
Indeed. And that was Behind Closed Doors for today.
Love Sport.
I believe we're going to have a Tory debate very soon.
Yes, we are.
Leadership chat.
So look, basically, we're on the brink now of getting a new Prime Minister, and I know this is mostly a sports station, and fair play, it's called Love Sport, the clue's in the name, but sometimes, you know, things happen outside the world of sport that are pretty massive, and getting a new Prime Minister is one of those things. And Boris Johnson and Jeremy Hunt have been going toe-to-toe now for quite a while. They've been going at it hammer and tongue, and we are at the culmination now of this. So basically, the voting in the Tory leadership race closes today. Mm-hmm. And we should know, or we will know tomorrow, who the next Prime Minister is going to be. Theresa May will take her very last Prime Minister's questions time on Wednesday, and then she will hand over the reins to what is probably going to be Boris Johnson. So, you know, that's essentially where we are. Now, we're supposed to be getting Tory MP Daniel Kavczynski on the line. I think we'll be speaking to him quite shortly. But yeah, when you look at things like, for example, what we've got now. So, with Iran, when it's all kicking off over there. Now, Boris Johnson hasn't got the best track record of kind of like tactful diplomacy. Mm. In fact, he normally goes in a little bit like a steroid-induced bull in a china shop and just smashes everything to pieces and revels in the chaos. In fact, actually, that's just called the Bullingdon Club, which, of course, he was a part of when he was at Oxford. Now, you know, you have to ask, is he really the type of person that we can potentially trust with regards to our country? And, I mean, Rich, you obviously, I think, like, you know, no, I don't mean any disrespect to you or our listeners, but I think you have a kind of a skin-deep approach to politics. What do you want from a prime minister? What is it when you think, oh, if you could draw a prime minister, someone who's not massively into politics, you've got other stuff on, what is it you want?
Okay, that's an interesting question.
You know, do you want them to be good-looking?
No, look, for me, it's more a case of what they stand for. The bit that gets me with Boris Johnson, again, this is someone who knows very, very little about politics, and of course, leave that to you on this show, is the fact that, I guess, looking at him, it's hard to see him as that leader. Now, of course, he has certain leadership qualities, but in terms of looking after himself, some of the things that have happened in his life, you do then wonder whether he is the type that's able to drive the nation forward. I would question that. So what am I looking for? I guess first and foremost, somebody that you can look at and be really impressed by. I don't see him as a particularly impressive character, personally.
Yeah, I mean, you lament his lack of core. Well,
and this is maybe because of my background. I think that, okay, what should be the core, not the actual core, but the core of what he is? Well, it should be someone that does take care of themselves, that has all the different areas of their life to an extent they're on top of. Whereas with Boris Johnson, from what I understand, he is very, very intelligent and is focused in certain areas, but there are certain other areas that he's very unintelligent, that you look at and just incredibly worrying. And you think, is he the person that we're going to look up to? I don't know. I'm not so sure.
No, it's not at all. I mean, he actually did quite a candid piece. So normally what happens in these, you know, in these leadership elections is some quite graphic detail about the candidate's personal life comes out. Now, with Boris Johnson, it wasn't just the fact, of course, that, you know, his partner, Carrie Symons, is a lot younger than him and was, you know, they were embroiled in some kind of blazing row, apparently. You know what? So was I that evening, but no one recorded it, so that was fine. But it's also that he apparently has a bit of a chorizo and cheese addiction, almost, which he says he's overcome. But that's just an interesting thing to know about our potential future envoy to the free world. On the line right now, it is my absolute pleasure to introduce Conservative MP Daniel Kavczynski. Daniel, how the heck are you today?
Very well, thank you. Good morning, Patrick.
Good morning, Daniel. Good to hear from you. Look, OK, so tomorrow we will know for sure who our next Prime Minister is going to be. Who's your money on and why?
Oh, definitely Boris Johnson. I had a sort of summer barbecue with my local party members in Shrewsbury on Sunday, and I think three quarters of them were voting for Boris. And anecdotally, that's the sort of evidence that we're getting from other Conservative MPs. He's overwhelmingly the favourite candidate to take over.
And look, a lot of people question his competence. A lot of people say maybe his slightly bungling approach to things might not go down that well when he's actually Prime Minister. Do you think he does have the capabilities to run this country well?
Well, I think we've seen in the way he has run one of the most important cities in the world very successfully over two terms, and he achieved a great deal whilst he was mayor. Certainly crime was much lower in London when he was mayor than it is at the moment under Sadiq Khan, and people are very pleased with the way that he ran our capital city. I have every confidence in him. I voted for him. I've had private discussions with him about his strategy and about his vision. And what really attracts me to him is that he's had the courage to really nail his colours to the mast over this Brexit issue, promising us to leave on the 31st of October. That is critical. So many people are now demoralized and frustrated that what we voted for has not been achieved. And that is why we have every hope and confidence that he will deliver that essential way forward for our country.
It looks as though several people are already lining up their letters of resignation as, or probably when, really, Boris becomes our next Prime Minister. Philip Hammond, of course, being one of them, the Chancellor of the Exchequer. I imagine, Daniel, you'll be very sorry to see him go.
yes, well, what I will say is I'm even more concerned than him going. I'm concerned about reports that there are potentially up to six Conservative MPs who, in their determination to prevent Brexit, could be joining the Liberal Democrats. Yes. Now, I'm just agog at how people are not, some people from all political parties are just simply not prepared to respect the decision of the British people and pull out of the European Union. And what I find fascinating, and whether it's Mr. Coveney from Ireland, whether it's the European Commission new president, or anybody else, they appear to be giving us an impossible situation. They're not prepared to renegotiate the withdrawal agreement, but they expect us somehow to back down and cave in and almost probably overturn Brexit because there is no alternative. So what they're saying is, it's the deal or nothing else. Well, the deal has failed to be ratified on three separate occasions by the House of Commons. The only alternative is a managed no deal. And I know that many of my companies in Shrewsbury are prepared and ready to fill out forms and to pay the tariffs. They do it with their American customers and their Canadian customers. They're very happy to do it with their European partners. So these people who are trying to frighten your listeners about what a managed no deal would mean are misleading them and not respecting the democratic will of the British people.
Are you all right to just outline for people? Because I think that's been one of the big questions that's been asked to me, really. Like, I was in the pub yesterday, and as you know, Daniel, I'm in there most days, actually. But I was in there yesterday, and a lot of my friends aren't overtly political. You know, fair enough. They've got other things on, I suppose. But they say, look, what would no deal be? What would it look like? You know, and I'm quite keen to get your take on that. What does a no deal Britain look like?
Well, a no-deal Britain actually gives us what a lot of us have been yearning for many years, which is we actually revert back to being a normal country, an independent sovereign nation, whereby the decisions that are taken that affect your listeners' lives day to day, the regulations they have to abide by, the court system that they have to at times navigate through, all of those decisions are taken by British people, accountable to them through British institutions. That's the way that most countries around the world operate, and that is a bedrock of the democratic system. Having outsiders in another country who are not accountable to you, over whom you have no control over it through the election process, is not something that many countries in the world are prepared to accept. So this European Union, which is now rapidly moving towards a supranational state, with one currency, one flag, one parliament, one foreign policy, and one EU army, is actually an increasingly unaccountable, undemocratic institution. We've seen that with the election of the new EU president. There was just one candidate, take it or leave it, a little bit like Pyongyang, I would say. And your listeners have absolutely no say over who she is, who the head of the central bank is. It's a very, very dangerous situation, and I'm just very, very grateful and thankful that we are finally leaving and becoming an independent sovereign nation. And the most important thing I can say is those people who are trying to thwart Brexit, why don't they just allow us and the British people who voted for it to demonstrate that Britain can have strong relations with Europe without being subsumed into the political structures. I think they need to respect the result of the referendum that took place 3 years ago.
Daniel Kovzinski, thank you very much. As ever, Conservative MP there, Daniel Kovzinski. I mean, look, Rich, I know, again, you know, you're not overly political and all that. Does it worry you, Brexit? Like, does the whole thing worry you? You're not bothered?
Truthfully, not overly bothered.
Yeah, that's fine though. Like, that's, you know,
not overly bothered. But then it's one of them, isn't it? It's kind of, obviously we'll see how it all falls out after.
Yeah.
And this is it, I guess you can look at both sides. It's the fact that it's been all that's been talked about now for what? How long are we talking? Oh, a year?
Years, 3 years.
Well, 3 years, but the last, so when was the actual vote again? So we've been...
Well, it was about three and a bit years.
Yeah.
Now.
Yeah. Which is just insane. And it's actually been a major headline pretty much most days since then.
Yeah, it has. I think everyone's pretty sick of Brexit, aren't they, now,
yeah,
really?
And it doesn't seem like we're all that much closer to actually knowing what's going to happen. And I guess that'll be it. It'll be, what, back end of the year that we'll then have a bit of an idea as to what the fallout will be and whether it's going to be a hugely positive thing or not.
This is Love Sport.
We do have Dillian White's trainer on the line very shortly, Mark Tibbs. And this obviously comes after Dillian White managed to win in a unanimous points victory at the O2 London Arena against Oscar Rivas on Saturday night. A fantastic performance for Dillian White, whose stock continues to rise, actually, in what is already a stellar heavyweight division. Surely, he is now due another shot at the proper, proper big time against a Deontay Wilder, against an Anthony Joshua, against a Tyson Fury. It's only a matter of time. So it's going to be great to hear from Mark Tibbs. See what's behind Dillian White's kind of emergence, really, gone from that level of just being a very, very good heavyweight to potentially being in that top tier.
Yeah, well, you spoke earlier about the background story, and it's quite a fascinating story, one that I didn't know, as to his upbringing.
Yeah.
We said dad at 13.
Shot twice. He's been stabbed three times.
Stitched up his own wound.
So A, didn't go to hospital and they got police involved, and B, well, he was one point, he had to get a bullet out of his own body because he didn't want to go to hospital, he didn't want his mum to worry.
Mm.
You know, a staggering story behind Dillian White's success.
Indeed. We're going to be talking, as you say, to Mark Tibbs very shortly. We're also going to be talking showbiz very shortly. We've got Sarah Louise Robertson, who will be on the line very shortly to go through the latest showbiz headlines. Of course, the other main headlines today, we spoke earlier to Shane Lowry's golf club, Ray Molloy. Fantastic Chelsea. Great achievement from Shane Lowry yesterday. Did you get a chance to watch much of the golf?
Yeah, I did, actually.
What just happened? You looked like you just got bitten.
Did you see a...
No, oh, I saw nothing.
Okay, fantastic. I'm seeing things. I thought I'd just been stung by a wasp. So, good-o. You know, because that's the only reason I'm so panicky about that kind of stuff is, apart from all the obvious reasons, I've never been stung by a bee or a wasp. And so I don't know if I've got some kind of horrible, deadly allergy. But anyway, there we are. Yeah, so it was fantastic to speak to Shane Lowry's golf club member there, Ray Molloy. I mean, it's just such a nice, heartwarming story, I find.
Yeah, it is indeed. I wanted to touch on Brooks Koepka, because I know we've spoken about him quite a bit on the show recently. Again, another top finish. Disappointment from the end yesterday. He wasn't quite as good as maybe as he wanted to be. I think he shot a 3-over yesterday and ended up finishing joint fourth. But he is consistently there or thereabouts.
Well, he is. And I think, as you just said there, you know, it's the first time this year he's finished outside the top four. You know, that is remarkable. It's a staggering level of consistency that you don't normally see from any golfer. I mean, just have a look around. Look at the way Rory McIlroy is disintegrated on numerous occasions. Brooks Koepka just doesn't seem to do that. But I think it's interesting that he was actually really struggling to play at one point. It's not in this tournament. This is a good number of years ago, before he properly burst onto the scene. His back was just an absolute nightmare. He just couldn't get sorted with his back. He couldn't you know, he basically just simply could not play golf. And so he'd gone through various different levels of things, physios, chiropractors, and they went to a horse chiropractor.
That's when you know it's
desperate. It's like, oh, hey Jim, why are we going to the stables? Don't ask, Brooks. Don't ask. And then they get to the stables, and anyway, the guy fixes his back within 45 seconds.
Wow.
Apparently, and now look at him. He's a multi-millionaire whose missus looks like something out of Greek mythology, and he is winning major golf events all around the globe.
Winning at life.
To be honest, when you think, like, we're just Brooks in it, mate. If you're doing very well, I'm just Brooks in it, mate. You know? Yeah,
indeed. So, fantastic achievement yesterday, though, from Shane Lowry. Gone into depth about that today. Also spoke a little bit about the breaststroke, which is something we haven't spoke about on this show before.
Well, normally, our producers prevent me from talking about breaststroke until after the watershed, but apparently today that hasn't applied. So we can talk about Adam Peaty's record. But we have a very, very special guest on the line now, Rich, don't we?
We do indeed. We spoke a lot about the boxing. Of course, Dillian White successful at the weekend. Please say, we've got Mark Tibbs, Dillian White's trainer, on the line. Morning, Mark.
Morning, Patrick.
Morning. You must be really pleased with the performance at the weekend.
Very, very pleased. You know, we worked, we knew what we had in front of us, a very, very dangerous operator in Oscar Rivas, and he weren't no walkover, and he's been an avoided fighter and not for nothing. So, Dillian likes challenges, and so we accepted the fight, and he done a masterclass performance, Dillian White did, for sure. And entertained the public in the process.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. And I was saying this before. I would rather watch Dillian White fight than Anthony Joshua. Because it's not that you don't quite know what you're going to get. You do know what you're going to get. You're going to get a good show. There's going to be thrills and spills along the way. He might go down. He might knock his opponent down. It's always going to be a great fight. And it's because he's such a hard man. Now, we had Conor Benn in the studio with us on Friday. And he just said, I just asked him about Dillian White. And this look came over his face. It was like a look of terror. He just said, look, I would never want to fight him. I would never want to fight him. I think you read a lot about his backstory as well. There was a big piece in this on what he's overcome, you know, being shot and stabbed, etc., etc.
Yeah.
What is he actually like as a bloke? What's his actual mentality like as a bloke?
Well, he's a tough, tough man. He's a stubborn man. He's a non-conformist, so to speak. But He's got fighting credentials that, you know, people only dream of, and a big, massive heart. So when you've got them ingredients, it's great to work with and nurture and mould. And he's turned into a fine, young, mature man now. He's maturing as a man and as a fighter as well. So that's what happens when you come through battles like you saw at the weekend, and I'm very, very pleased with how he's turning out, fighting wise and as an individual wise, for sure. Yeah, but no, his background is a very interesting background, and that's what's made him a very tough guy. That's what I believe, anyway.
Great stuff. Got to ask you about, and I appreciate you're going to be slightly biased here, of course, for obvious reasons. But the big three ahead of him, obviously Wilder, AJ, and Tyson Fury. If he were to face those three, and of course he will face Wilder, if he were to face those three, how does he get on against them now?
Well, listen, look, it's all about styles, and the actual two styles gel. I mean, Wilder's style and Fury's style, long and rangy. And there's one more element to come from Dillian White, which he hasn't showed yet, and that's what's going to if he faces either of them opponents, we know what to do and how to handle the Wilders and the Furies. But you know, it's heavyweight boxing, as we say, and they're big men. They can punch hard, and you know, if they find the target before we do, you know, it has an effect. But we actually know what to do with them styles. To rough them up and to break that body and then go upstairs, so to speak. But yeah, without giving too much away, it's easy for a boxing man to know what to do with the styles of Deontay Wilder and Tyson Fury.
Well, why is it, do you think, that Dillian seems to be not getting the shot that you, I think a lot of people think he deserves. And his rise, especially in the last couple of years, really, and the standard of his performances, the regularity with which he's dishing out quite serious violence, actually, onto anyone who dares to step into the ring with him. Well, why is it that he isn't being given maybe the same opportunities that, for example, Anthony Joshua was given earlier on in his career?
Well, you know, that's something that's baffled us all in boxing. I believe it's politics and maybe a little bit of skullduggery against us. I don't know. That means like looking after their champion, the WBC. You know, it's quite obvious to see that you know, who needs a Dillian White in the ring with them. And but sometimes he's got to himself to a point now, Dillian, that they have to face him. He's got the public behind him now, and it's just getting bigger and bigger. And, you know, they want to see Dillian on the TV because he delivers, he entertains, and he don't avoid no one. I mean, he's not a con man, so to speak, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. He's a real fighting man, and it proved that on Saturday night.
Could you just talk us through, like, Dillian White's kind of daily training thing, really? Like, especially in the run-up to a fight, I'm quite keen to gauge, like, what time does it start? How intense is it? You know, how many calories is he eating? All that kind of stuff.
Well, listen, it differs at different stages of camp. Mm. So if you're talking about a run-up to the week, we don't do too much, to tell the truth. We tick over. He monitors his food intake. He eats the right fuel to fuel his body. And he gets plenty of rest in. And basically, we tick over, we keep the leaders going, and we tighten up. That's what we do fight week. That's what we do, and that's what most fighters do.
Excellent. Well, look, tell you what, keep doing what you're doing because it's working, Mark, and it's fantastic to have you on the show as well. I really appreciate you making the time for us. Mark Tibb there, Dillian White's trainer. Dillian White, of course, getting yet another win under his belt against Oscar Rivas, a bloke who apparently Eddie Hearn thought would knock him out. Wrong he was.
Indeed. Love Sport. We've got a very special guest on now, haven't we?
We do. We do indeed.
We do indeed. We have Roy Molloy, or Ray Molloy, I believe, from Shane Lowry's golf club at Esker Hills. Of course, a historic win for Shane Lowry yesterday, won by 6 shots. Brilliant performance in the Open. Good morning, Ray.
Good morning from a very happy Esker Hills.
I bet it is. How did you guys celebrate yesterday?
We're still celebrating.
Of course you are. Of course you are.
If you understand that this is open-ended.
Yeah. So talk to me. Was there a big group of you that like got together to watch the final day?
Yeah. We are a small club here in the middle of Ireland in County Offaly. A small club with only 210 members. And Shane is the local boy. He just lives down the road. So he came here as a 13-year-old young fella and asked could he play golf and went out and played with his father for a few years and just developed his skills from there. So on yesterday, there was a good crowd here on Saturday, and on yesterday at 12 o'clock, the crowd began to come in, and it was sitting room only when he hit off on the first tee. And then as the time was on, the crowd got bigger, and by 4 o'clock, by the ninth hole, it was standing room only. 4 televisions going, and every shot was hit with quietness, and every shot was cheered. It was like no other day ever in this golf club.
Oh, fantastic. I mean, that's what it's all about, isn't it? You always think of these golf stars as being these great international superstars, but they've all got roots somewhere, haven't they? And it means so much to the local community. You know, look, when he came in at about 12 or 13, as you said, what was he like as a boy and as he matured into the golfer that he is today?
He was only one of the boys that came and used to go together and get his bottle of Coke and his bar of chocolate and go off and play 18 holes. And sometimes the other kids would come in and they'd go home and Shane would go for an extra 9 holes. Mm. We saw that from a very early stage. He wanted to play more. And then when he got to 14, his schoolmates were trying to hit the green. He was trying to hit the pin.
Yeah.
And he was succeeding. That was the difference it developed into. And next thing, the boys were blading balls into the green and he was backspinning them. Mm-hmm. You know? And that's, he developed from there and he learned all the shots. Esker Hills is like a links course. Mm-hmm. And there's lots of mounds around the greens and every shot. And if he missed the shot today on a spot, he'd go back that evening with 10 balls and he practiced that shot and perfected. Right. And mostly, he got no tuition until he was 15. So he generally self-taught.
Brilliant. What did you make of, I mean, his mentality? You're going into those final few holes, and of course, even though we had a big lead or a decent lead, we know how that course can, we saw it on the final day, the fact that Holmes shot a 16 over par, you know, you can quite comfortably quadruple bogey a hole on that course. How impressed were you with his mentality in the last few holes?
Shane has a lovely smile, but he's very strong mentally, and he was always that, and he always wants to be better. And you saw him gritting his teeth there yesterday. And he might laugh off the course and then having a pint, but when he goes on the golf course, it's very serious, takes every shot seriously. And we knew, he learned a good bit from the US Open. We knew he was going in mentally stronger than ever before. And he needed all of that yesterday. I know the cushion was great. Mentally, he's very strong. And must be, when he won the Irish Open as an amateur, you know, he has to be way, he beat the professionals 10 years ago. And that went to a third extra hole playoff. Yeah. So his mental was put to the full test that day, and he survived it. So we were in doubt. We were a little bit concerned yesterday. We knew he had it, and with the few shots lead he had, we knew it was going to happen. From 15 on, you know, it was ole, ole, ole here. We knew it was going to happen.
Fantastic. And
on the 17th hole, on the screen, you might have seen the man in the engraving department took out the trophy, and he began putting the S on it. And the clubhouse nearly went mad.
Oh,
so
God.
We knew then. When we saw the engraver, he knew on the 17th hole that it was only, the claret jug was coming to Offaly and coming to Esker Hill.
Well, I was about to say, have you got room in any trophy cabinets there? Have you got any spare shells for this claret jug?
Well, now there'll be a special shell put up in that. And I said there'll be a monument put up for Shane because, he's the first guy to win the claret jug on Irish soil. I think he's the sixth Irish man to win it, you know, but no one from the Midlands. Don't forget, he didn't come from a golfing family. Mm. You know, so that a football family. He's from, yeah. You know, so that makes the whole occasion. But it's great credit to his family that stood behind them and tuned them in and all along. And that's why they're all with him there yesterday. It's a very closely knit community here in Esker Hills and Offaly. He lives about 2 miles down the road from us, you know. And that's why all the neighbours and non-golfers, they all came in here yesterday, and there was tears from many an old person that never thought they'd see the day.
Yeah, well, he was obviously very emotional when he's given his interview afterwards, talking about the family. We mentioned Esker Hills, and of course, it's going to bring big publicity for Esker Hills, no doubt. So do you expect then this to have a real positive impact on the golf course?
Absolutely. There's about 25 golfers gone out this morning. I don't know half of them. And I'm not sure where, and that wouldn't be the normal Monday morning. Yeah. You know, so there's no doubt it'll have a big positive effect. We're a unique club. We're in the middle of Ireland. We're beside a bog, a flat bogland, and still we're a hilly course. Esker Hills by name, and the Eskers that was formed by the glaciers 20,000 years ago, before my time. And it's a unique course, you know, and they claim that it's very lynx type course, and that's what brings golf on. That's how Shane developed his golf so good, for links courses, you know. And we always said that if he won a major, most likely it would be the British Open played on links, you know, and we were right about that.
Absolutely. Well, you've got a few things right when it comes to him, that's for sure. I do want to ask, have you managed to restock the bar yet, or is that still completely empty?
That's in progress. Special delivery in this morning. Special delivery coming in this morning at 12 noon, and we'll be back to full business again. Okay. But we take our golf serious as well here, so can't overindulge. We're just, you know, for a small club, it's just, there's hope for every club when you see what happened to Esker Hills.
Brilliant.
You know, someday they can have a young person that will just come out of the blue, and if they're lucky enough, and if they hone their skills well enough, and if everything goes well for them, you know what I mean? Shane didn't become champion golfer overnight. You know, the years of practice all tuned in yesterday. Yeah. You know, he didn't come out that bunker automatically yesterday, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's, for any young sports person, you know, they have to put in the effort, and sometimes, in a small number of cases, the huge results will come, and that certainly came for Shane yesterday. You know, we're so pleased here at Esker Hills. You know, small club, and for that to happen is, you know, it's unbelievable.
It really
is. Unbelievable. You know, with messages from all over the world, with a message and an email from California, I'd be with you in September.
Oh, brilliant.
Fantastic. Ray, really appreciate you coming on today. That's Ray Molloy from Shane Lowry's golf club, Esker Hills, which, as he said today, I've got no surprise. You can imagine if you live in the local area and you knew that Shane Lowry is from that golf course, you want to play that golf course.
But it's fantastic, isn't it? It's just one of these all-time really nice feel-good stories because it is a nice community over there. And there seems to... You know, I don't want to say this disparagingly. Again, you know, I've got Irish relatives and things. And there just seems to be a certain added degree of innocence to a lot of parts, especially kind of like rural Ireland. And, you know, it's just such a lovely family, old school atmosphere. And to have what is essentially a local golf course, I'm sure it's an absolutely magnificent golf course, but a local golf course there. And like you said, you know, you've got people just flocking there over the course of the day. More and more people arriving in the clubhouse, like they're drawn to this, like they can sense something special's happening. Yeah. I just think it's lovely, really nice.
Shane Lowry touched yesterday in his interview afterwards on family, and he got a little bit emotional when he gave his interview after his round. And obviously the family support, you do wonder how much of a part that's played, and it seems like it's a crucial part. Obviously Ray talked about it there, the fact that at the club as well, it was almost like an extended family, how happy they were for him, how much they bought into his success, because again, they had a part to play as well.
Yeah, well, 100%. And actually, I think it goes a long way to disparaging some of the myths that maybe Shane Lowry's gone on to about himself, because he's quite a big lad, you know, he doesn't necessarily look like your archetypal athlete as such, but... you know, and he's called himself very lazy over time. Well, it's not according to Ray. You know, from the moment he took up golf at 13 years old, him and his mates would go around, they'd have a hit, then he'd do an extra 9 holes. Then if he messed up any shots on that, he'd take 10 balls out and do it himself. He wasn't just trying to hit the green, he was trying to hit the pin. He taught himself. He didn't have a golf lesson until he was 15. So he's basically taught himself for the first 2 years. That's not lazy. That's world class.
Yeah, no.